cool.
I'm Kelly Wilkins, and I am an alcoholic.
My
sobriety birth date is July 4th of 1998, and I have a home group, and we meet at the Timberlake Christian Fellowship, Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in Lynchburg on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday at 8 o'clock. And if you would like to join us, we would love to have you. So if you're ever in town, you can stop by and see us. Wednesday night is a beginner meeting, so we stick to the first three steps, and then we have a tradition meeting, a speaker meeting, a step meeting, and a closed discussion meeting. So I'm supposed to share in a general way what I used to be like and what I am now, and I'm going to share in a very general way because I'm not here to take a fifth step, so try not to do that here. And I do want to apologize to the group that I was a little bit late. Ran into a little traffic, and then a sponsee backed out on me after I rode to their house to pick them up, and they weren't there. So my plan was to get here in half an hour early, but anyway, I just prayed and give it to God, and that's all I can do. Okay, so this is my least favorite thing to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. It really is. And I'm going to share about, you know, because I need to identify myself, and I can tell you that I drank a lot, way too often and way too much at a very young age. I'm very much in my story. You'll probably hear about service work because I am very much about service. And all the happiest people that I see that give of themselves here are people that are in service work or working with others or making the coffee or speaking or one-on-one or doing correctional facility work, which is where my passion lies, only because I was incarcerated at one time for 6 months and we didn't have Alcoholics Anonymous there. And since that time, I can see the lives that's been rebuilt by having that brought into institutions and people having taken the steps and things of that nature and get out and they live purposeful lives now. So even if a seed can get planted, it's, you know, that's all we can do is plant a seed. So I'm originally from the Tidewater area, and I'm one of six girls, and my mother and dad divorced when I was very young, and half of my sisters went to live with my dad. He was a military man, and the other three of us lived with my mom, and she had to work a lot to take care of us girls, which left plenty of time for us to kind of do on our own, whatever it was. And I was the oldest of the two younger, and I hated babysitting, and I just, you know, couldn't do a very good job of it. So from my earliest recollection, you know, in this story that I'm going to share real quick, I had a stepfather, which drank a lot and would come home, and the house would be filled with arguing and fighting and my mom getting beat up on and things of that nature, and her having to go to work with sunglasses and a black eye and stuff. But all of that stuff, different stuff, is not what makes me an alcoholic. When I take a drink, I don't know when I'm going to stop. I don't know. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm going to have another one. But nobody else's alcoholism is why I have it. I know that I'm allergic to alcohol. I know that when I take one drink, I'm going to have another one. And all of that usually starts in my mind before I have a drink. Things aren't going right or things are going good, and I've just always been a person of more. You know, if you just give me a little bit more, I'm going to feel a little bit better, and all this other stuff is going to go away, whether it's happy stuff or good stuff. It's just to enhance that feeling, because I always had the feeling that I was never quite good enough. I never quite fit in. Went to four different schools when I was in the fourth grade because we moved a lot, because when this stuff would happen at home, my mother would get us on the Greyhound bus and we'd move to Lynchburg. That's where she's originally from, to get away from my stepfather, but we would always go back. And, you know, it's really rough when you're a new kid, 11, 12 years old in the fourth grade and getting picked on and not having the right clothes or the right shoes or whatever. And so I never really fit in with the smart kids at school or really the ones that were getting into trouble. I was just kind of there in the middle, and, you know, I was the last to get picked for football, like kickball. We'd have kickball and different little teams and stuff like that. And so when I was in the seventh grade, you know, these two guys and a couple of girls invited me to go after school, well, really it was at lunchtime, into the woods in the back. And I knew what they did in the woods in the back. They looked like they had a good time, and I'd heard of what went on. And I went, which meant, you know, I didn't come back to class, because that day was the first day I drank Mad Dog 2020, smoked a cigarette, came home with a hickey on my neck, and other things that we won't talk about. And was so sick when I got home and throwing up and this red stuff. And my dad, you know, my stepdad told my mom she's been drinking. And I was like, no, it was just something, the shrimp or the something with the cocktail sauce. It was just, anyway, he wasn't having none of it. But my mom, you know, believed me. And so many years later, I remember that happening on a Wednesday. And I stayed home from school on Thursday. But I could not wait to get back to school on that Friday to be with those kids, because they accepted me. And I didn't really realize, I know now, I didn't really realize then it was, you know, when I drank and when I did this stuff and I hung around them, it just made me feel a part of, because I just felt so lonely inside. You know, I just had this hole inside and didn't know where I fit in anywhere, you know. And I just knew that I was tired of that man coming home doing that to my mom. And I just did not want to be there. I did not want to be who I was, where I was, and whatever I could do to escape that environment is what I did. And these kids were older than me, and some had driver's license, and some weren't even in school. And, you know, I'm like 15, 16, and I'm out with these 27-year-old people as time goes by. And I just go along and do whatever they do. And I liked it. I liked it. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any job. And they provided everything. Just come along for the ride. And I can tell you, it just made me feel like I was somebody and that I belonged, is the only thing that I can explain. And with that, you know, came a lot of staying out late at night, not coming home, worrying my parents to death, skipping school, stealing, because, you know, back when I first got invited to do all of this stuff, they had the wine and stuff. But after a while, when they would pass it around to me, they would notice I would kind of chug-a-lug it a little bit. And they would say, hey, go to the Revco, because back then they sold wine, and maybe they still do now, I don't know. And they said, steal your own. So that's what I started to do. I started going in grocery stores and stealing bottles of wine at a very young age. And anything that would just not make me have this hole and this loneliness feeling is what I sought after. So, my mom, on one of her trips of moving, we moved to Lynchburg, and I was 16, and I was beyond parental control. So I know what it's like to have been locked up in a juvenile Bonnier detention center, because back then they came and took you to court when you didn't go to school, and they'd send you away and go to these girls' halfway houses, and all I had to do was just live there and go to school. But I just hated it, because I had already started this journey and I wasn't like those kids. And, you know, I'd get kicked out of places like that. And, you know, then I found myself pregnant at 17, and the father didn't want to marry me. And you know, so at 18 years old, here I am, this single mother. And after I had my son, you know, that partying don't quit, you know. So I would be leaving him with my mom to babysit. And where I'm from down there, people don't go out partying because of the after-hour bars. They don't open up till like 12 at night, so you would kind of party before, but you didn't really go out till later on and stay out all night long. And I found myself doing that. And, you know, I can remember one evening that I'm not proud of, but, you know, my mom didn't live too far from where I had an apartment. And by the way, I supported myself by welfare and food stamps and the charity of others, and would work jobs underneath the table, and not really anything legal, just enough to get by or whatever you could give me. That I just felt like I had been dealt such a bad hand that y'all and everybody owed me something. And if I don't watch what I'm doing today, I can still feel like that. You know, like the world just owes me something. And all that is selfishness and self-centeredness. Because that's the root, the book tells me. That's my problem. And I'm still like that to a degree today. So anyway, you know, one evening I, you know, go to her house and there's a fenced-in yard. And she'd already told me she couldn't babysit. And I kind of like tooted the horn, and she came out and I put him over the fence and said, I'll be back, you know, in an hour. And that's what I would do. And then you wouldn't, I mean, I'd come in the next morning, but then I'd be so strung out and hungover and everything that she wouldn't allow him to come back home with me. And I guess I believe that God looks after drunks and little kids, you know, because that's certainly what has been in my story. So I thought that, you know, his father said, well, if you move back to Lynchburg, I'll be able to be a father and spend time and help. You know, so here I am. I'm like my mother. My son's almost, you know, 5 years old. He's four, and I know he's going to be going to school soon. And I've got to, like, you know, you can't be doing this, because I'd made it up in my mind that this kid was going to go to the same elementary school, the same middle school, the same high school, and we were not moving around. And whatever that meant that I had to do is what we did, so that he could have a stable environment. And so I moved up here, and that went good for a little while. The streets rolled up, you know, pretty early in Lynchburg at night, and I went from, like, the disco era into the pool halls and the country music and shooting pool. And, you know, so wherever I go, I'm going to find the crowd of people that like to drink like I like to drink. And then I had an aunt that would babysit him up here, because that was my mother's sister, and he was the first grandson and nephew, so they just, you know, and it just left me free rein to do whatever I wanted to do. You know, I'm not going to hang in this drunkalogue very long, but I can tell you that before I made it to Lynchburg, you know, I would stay in motels over in Ocean View so that I could go to the after-hour club, so that I could rip the money off from the Navy guys so that we could party and have money for the next day for a motel room. And I don't remember all those people's name, but after getting in the program and, you know, having a sponsor and a home group that's very important, you know, they told me I was going to have to pay that stuff back, and that we'd put a certain amount on that money, and we would, and if I couldn't do it face to face, you know, I would have to send it to some organization, and I've been able to do that, which is further along. I'd also stay with an older aunt that walked on a walker over in Ocean View, and I'd wait for my son to go to sleep at night, and then I would sneak out of the house. Now, here she is on a walker in her 80s. He's 4 years old, asleep, and I leave him like that, and then I get out there, and then I get to drinking, and then this paranoia sets in, like, oh God, what if something's happened to him? What if the house catches on fire? So I'm zooming back to this house, and I'm beating on the door, and the poor woman can't even barely make it to the door to open the door for me, because she's on a walker. So when she finally gets there, I just brush by her. She falls down, and I run to the bedroom to be sure he's okay, because that's all I can think about is me and what's going on. And she used to have this pocketbook that hung over her walker, a big pocketbook that she would keep her money in. And when I would stay with her over there, because it wasn't too far from the bars that I like to go to, I would literally crawl down on my hands and knees on my stomach to reach around in her pocketbook that hung on the walker to take the money. Because that's what I am. You know, I am I can't quit drinking. I can't quit partying. I don't think I need to work a job, and so I'll steal from you or anything that I can do to get what I want and to give my son whatever it is he needs. And after getting in this program and getting a sponsor and going through the steps many times, you know, I had been told ill-gotten gains will get you nowhere. But that's how I live my life. So we came to Lynchburg. He was five. I got a job as a waitress. That's all I could ever do was bartend because I could drink behind the bar. The places that I worked, they didn't care if you drank as long as you didn't get out of the way. So then I started getting these DUIs and driving on suspended license because back then, you know, you could go to North Carolina and get a driver's license and they just gave you like this number, not your Social Security number. And so I would come up here with North Carolina tags and pretend like I was a college student. Well, after going through many road checks and then realizing that you're not a college student, you know, I had to get a regular license. And I could get a regular license for a little while. I just could never keep it. I could never keep it. I couldn't keep the insurance up, or I'd get a DUI, or, you know, SR-22s. My God, I wish I had all the money that I have spent on lawyer fees and fines and everything. So I continued to live in this one place, and he went to kindergarten, and I tried to work. And, you know, I would take him to all these after-school programs so I can say that he never did come home and be alone. But, you know, so he would go to the Cub Scouts and the Boy Scouts, and he'd go to karate practice, and he'd go to all these things, and then that left me time to go to happy hour. Because when they would meet, 4 to 7 was happy hour, and that's when he would go do his thing. And on the second to my last DUI, I was sitting up at a place in a bar drinking tequila, and he's at the skating rink on the speed team, and I need to go pick him up, and the bartender asked me, you know, after I'd had ever how many, she said, "You don't want another one, do you?" And I said, "No, I got to pick my son up at the skating rink," and I paid my tab and I left. And so when I got to the skating rink, the police was there because she had called the police because, you know, I guess she didn't want anything to happen to me or my son, and she could have been responsible. So there I am. I get arrested in the Skateland parking lot. My aunt comes to get my son, and I go to jail, and paid a big fine, lost my license for that. Doesn't matter about me losing a license because I'm going to do what I think I'm above authority. And that I can do what I want. And so after then, I just got another car, put it in someone else's name, and drove. You know, but then I would get in these bad car accidents. And it's just but for the grace of God that I have not yet killed anybody drinking and driving. My son wasn't in the car with me one time when we got in a bad accident. And I just want to share this because it's real important. I remember when we went to the hospital and they put him on this stretcher, and he was like, I don't know, 10, 11. You know, I remember us getting to the emergency room, and I remember him looking up at me and saying, "Mom," because he was scared. He said, "If I got to die, I know I'm going to heaven." And I was like, "What? You know, nothing's going to happen to you, Ryan. Everything's okay." And then I kept figuring out, where did he learn this from? Where did he get, you know, and it just went on, and he was fine. And this one lady that he would go spend the night with her son had been taking him to church with her. And she said, "Yeah, Kelly, yeah, he knew that because he was going to this Kiwanis thing with her kid at a church." And so he knew at that scary moment what was going to happen to him. And I thought, all I did was drop him off, and they were going and doing this, you know, things that I should have been doing. And that was kind of an eye-opener. And I would try not to drink. And I would think just one would be okay, just so I could kind of settle down and calm down, and one is just all right. But I could never just have just one. I don't, my body is not built like that, quote, ever normal drinker. I can't have just one. So anyway, so I just lived like that. And then I started going to jail. And my aunt would take, or my mom would take care of my son, and they never would tell him where I was at. You know, they did real good by me. I thought I could work and not turn it into the welfare, so I got caught for welfare fraud, didn't care, kept drinking. got put on to suspended 2 years on parole. Then I started working at an Elks Lodge, and that's a man's club. And you could drink there, too, as long as you didn't get out of the way. Well, that was the thing, you know. One night I'm sitting there, and I'm drinking, and I get off from work, and I'm dating this one guy that's now my husband. And this man started telling me about this woman he used to date. So I got a buzz, and I go home, and this is my last DUI and last of everything of what happened. I go home, I make this spaghetti. First I go work out. I'm drunk, I go work out. I got these sweatpants on, a halter top on. I'm go to work out, I come home, I make this spaghetti, and Buck, he comes over, and I start asking him about Linda. And he's like, Kelly, I'm going to go home tonight. You've been drinking, and I'm not going to have this discussion. And I was like, what about the food? I don't care about the food. I'm going to go home. You stay here. So when he left, my brain said, I'll fix you. So I just threw on a leather jacket, hair up in a ponytail in January, midriff on. And I go and I pick up a friend of mine, and we go to a bar in Lynchburg that's no longer there called Mud Puppies. Now, the person that I took with me, let's just say I'm not beneath anybody, but this was your Skid Row drunk. By the time at closing hour, they didn't want to be around me. They left. They didn't even want to be around me. And I remember that my bar bill was $62 and some change, and I drank a bunch of these things called B-52s and Coors Light. That's what I drank. And I think I'm looking pretty good now. Nobody's wanting to be around me, and I'm loud. And the one guy that I pick up to go with me, you know, he's done left or he's done something. So I get in the car, and, you know, my son, again, was with a friend or spending the night somewhere. And by this time, we're moving along. He's in high school. He's actually in the 12th grade. And so my mind starts thinking, you know, I wonder who's over at Buck's house. You know, so, you know, there's got to be that Linda over there, right? You know, like, I got to go see, you know, of course there's somebody over there. So I ride by, and this is like 2:15, 2:30, you know, whatever. And there wasn't anybody there. The lights were off. And so as I was coming down this lakeside drive, and there was a moose club here, these lights got behind me. And my brain was like, oh, my God, you know, I could just see. I mean, like when the lights are behind you, you really sober up pretty quick, or at least I did. And I was like, oh, no, this is it, like the fifth DUI, and I'm on probation. But if I can beat him down to the quickie store and get out real quick, he can't prove I'm driving. And so that's what I tried to do. And I got out and was walking into the quickie, and he tapped me on the shoulder and asked me to come back to the car. And of course, I couldn't walk the line, and I refused to blow the thing up because, I mean, I knew that that was it. You know, I'm really going away this time. I mean, I just, and everything just flashed across me. And I remember sitting in that back seat, and I said, look, man, I cannot afford another DUI. I can't, you know, I'm on probation for bad checks. I'm due to get off in June. Like, can we just work this thing out? And he was like, Miss Perry, if you don't be quiet, I'm going to write you up for something else. And so I just started crying. I just crying, go on down to the jail. And the next morning, they let me make a phone call, and I called my son. Now, my son, he worked part-time at Chick-fil-A, and he was getting ready to graduate. And he and a friend came to pick me up. And he went to get the car out of impoundment. They allowed him to do that. And we went home. And I want to just say that the friends that my son has had and still has, at least he's told me to the best of my knowledge, nobody's ever said anything bad about me to him. And there's many more other stories of me coming home drunk with him having friends there and me thinking I've went to bed in my bedroom and I'm on the sofa with just a bra and underwear on, and these kids are on the floor in a sleeping bag. And when I come to myself, I'm like, oh, my God, and I run in the bedroom. How many times somebody might have seen me like that? I don't know. You know, I don't know. But anyway, so he come to get me, And we came home, and he needed to go to school. And I went straight to the refrigerator, and I had this much left, a little bit left in some wine. And my I've been drinking, you know. I didn't know it then. People would call it willpower. Like, why would she be drinking now? But I had been drinking since about 3:30 the previous day up till 2. And when I came home at whatever time that was, 9 in the morning, I physically needed a drink. It wasn't that I just wanted to get drunk. I physically needed the drink. And I went to the refrigerator and got the wine and turned it up. And I had the phone book out, and I'm looking for the lawyer, because I'm always looking for the lawyer, because I'm always in trouble. And my son had this look on his face, and he said, "Mama, I just came and got you. Why are you drinking?" And I said, "Ryan, everything's going to be okay. I've got to try to find a lawyer, and we're all going to be good." And he just stood there with this look in his face, and he left. And so I tried to find the lawyer, and of course that's how I went. Well, anyway, not only did I do all that night, but I cussed the boss out at where I worked at, so I no longer had a job. I still kept drinking because I knew that this felony DUI would mean I was going down the road for a long time. And so I just said, what the crap, you know? I might as well just bring it on. If I'm going, I'm going drunk. And so a man that had come into that club, not my husband, but another man, he had come into the Elks Lodge, and I noticed he would just come in to play cards, and I would cash his chips out. And he always drank Coke. And I remember before this last incident, him saying to me, "Kelly, me and my wife would love to take you to an AA meeting if you think you'd like to go." And I looked at him, and I was like, well, I don't need to go to that. And it was a week later that's when they put your name on the TV back then, you know, arrested for so-and-so and so-and-so. And there I was. So I got to wondering about that, and I called this guy up on the phone, and I couldn't get him. And they did fire me from the Elks Lodge, but they didn't have nobody to work through the rest of that weekend. So I went to work, and now I'm driving my son's car, because I take the car that I can't drive, and I put the tags in his name, and he goes off with a friend, and I take the car that I give to him to go to work, because I drive without licenses. I don't ask anybody to take me anywhere. And so the weekend that they let me work, it was on a Friday night, and I was sitting there, and I was realizing all of this stuff that was coming down. And I was hoping to see the man that had asked me about the AA meeting, but he didn't come in that night. And, you know, so I had a few drinks, and it was closing time, and it was me and only one other person in there, and then they left. You know, and I was the one that locked the place down, so I just drank more. And then I got to thinking, what about this AA thing, you know? So I looked in the phone book, and I found Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I called this phone number, and this woman answered the phone. And this woman had the worst, like I can't even tell you the southern drawl this woman had. But she just went on, and she just went on about if I was done and if I felt the same way the next morning, she'd carry me to an AA meeting. And I was like, I just need to know how not to get in trouble. I just need to know how I can drink safely and not get in trouble. When I got to you people, I did not know that I was done. I wanted to get out of trouble. I'd lost my job. I was on probation. I thought AA is going to go to court with me and get me out of trouble, and all this is going to work out, because I'm not your normal drinker that you see on TV with the trench coat and down under the bridge and all of, you know, I'm not like that. So anyway, she kept talking. She said, there's a 10:30 meeting on Sunday, and she said, I'll come and get you. And so the next morning, hungover from that night, sitting there drinking by myself, and how I didn't get pulled that night, I don't know. I get pulled every time. So it was like about 9:15, and I said, you know, I've got to call that woman, because if I get to that meeting, they're going to help me get out of trouble. I mean, I've got to get there. So she came and picked me up, and my first meeting was at 10:30 on a Sunday morning, down at the Salvation Army in Lynchburg. It was called the Oz Meeting then, and it's called the Gateway Meeting now, and it's a recovery house for men. And but at that time, they just had an AA meeting. And so when I got to that meeting, here I am. I am I am like white as a ghost. I've been dry heaving all night. I'm sick. I'm scared. I don't have cigarettes. You know, she don't smoke in the car. Jeez. You know, I'm like, and she just talked and she just talked. And I thought, if I get out of this car, I'll never get up in this car again. Just, you know. So we got down there and out front stood three guys. And to this day, they're sober. And I just seen one at a meeting Friday at noon. But there was these three guys. And she introduced me to them. And I didn't know how long they'd been sober. But one gave me a cigarette, and the other one was like, it's going to be okay. Come on in. Just come on in. We'll get you a cup of coffee. And I went in, and they got me a cup of coffee. And, you know, they only filled it halfway full. I was just shaking. I was crying. I was just scared. And I really wanted a drink because that would take that away. And I don't know what all they shared in that meeting. But I do know that during that first meeting, I'll never forget it. I don't want to never forget it, was that I kind of put my head down on the table and I was just like, I was so tired. And I just let this breath out that seemed to last the whole time there. And what I've come to know today is that I felt safe. I felt safe just for that 1 hour. And if anyone comes to my home group, I want them to feel safe. I want people to reach out. You know, everyone says, you know, well, the newcomer needs to reach out and all that stuff is true and whatever. But we also need to reach out, too, for people that can't do that. So, and that's what they did for me that day. And you know, after the meeting, someone said, would you like to go to one tonight? And I was like, no, I've got to get home and I've got to get things straightened out. You know, I'm getting ready to go to jail and, you know, I got to do blah, 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 blah. And they were like, well, you know, you don't have a job. Your kid's okay, you know, come to a meeting. So I went home, my son wasn't there, and I was kind of scared, and I was thinking about getting a drink, and I said, well, let me call this woman up again, you know, let me just call her, because she came, and that kind of started my journey into AA. I went to treatment at Pathways. But because I'm so manipulative and I need a job because I know I'm going to need work release. See, I'm always manipulating about me that I couldn't go in for the 28 days. I mean, I could have, but it was like I had to have a job. And I had to have a daytime job because I knew what was coming. And my probation officer told me, he said, Kelly, he said, I'm not going to violate you right now because you haven't been convicted of this felony. He said, but we'll wait and see what happens. And so so I went to every day, what is it called, intensive outpatient, whatever, every day. And then I'd go to these groups and stuff, and they would ask you, have you been drinking, and go around. And I'd be like, yeah. And the woman said, well, if you come in here again and say you've had a drink, we're going to recommend that you come in for the 28 days. And I said, okay. And I thought, I ain't never telling them again about me taking a drink. So I came in January of 98, but my last drink was not until July 4th of 98. So I started going around with these ladies and having a drink here and there. And I didn't know it was a non-drinking program, and neither is the man that I'm married to now. And so I said, I'm going to these meetings. I'm hearing everybody, you know, you got to get honest. You know, you got to pick the phone up, call when you think you want to take a drink, pray and just ask God to please take that thought away from you. And the God that I knew was a get you God. And I just thought, oh, Lord, you know, this God ain't going to do anything for me. When I look back today now, I should not be alive. This is in a very general way, but I am surprised that I am not dead today. Because when I do things, I do them, and I do them big. And you could read about somebody like me in the paper where somebody has shot and killed this girl and threw her in the James River, and you'd think, oh, that poor girl. But underneath it, it would be the alcoholism because it was what I had done before that. Because I'm going to rip you off, and I'm going to try to get what I can get. And the type of people that I hung around with, they didn't play like that. And I can just name so it would take me forever to tell you all the scrapes that I've got out just by the little touch, just by a little hair that God was with me even when I did not know that. So I started coming to AA. And I started making the coffee, and I got this home group, and it was all good. And people, you know, and it was getting closer to the court date, and I was staying away from that drink one day at a time. That was a big thing for me, just one day at a time. I had people, I lived alone with my son, but I had people that would tell me to call them. And actually, one lived, Sam, he's retired from Pathways and has passed away now. However, he lived at the end of the corner. Another lady, Mary Carter, lived here, and I lived here. And back then, I made a round to this person's house, to this. They'd say, walk around the block. They'd say, take a bath. They'd say, call. They'd say, pray. They'd say, read something. And after a while, I was just like, you know, I'm not getting no sleep here. And they said, you know, God, because I couldn't sleep. I could not. And they said, when God wants you to go to sleep, Kelly, you're going to sleep. Other than that, nobody's ever died from a lack of sleep. I mean, just all this stuff they would say, and I just was like, I just want to get out of trouble. That's what all I want to do is just, like, be normal. Well, I'm not a normal drinker, whatever that is. I'm not that. I never will be that. What is that thing about, you know, you can't turn a cucumber back into a pickle or vice versa? What, I can't. You know, if I go out and drink today, it's not because Alcoholics Anonymous does not work. It's because I chose to throw the towel in, and I just want to escape. And that's mainly what it is, the way I feel today. When something's going on, I want to escape, not so much drink. I just don't want to deal with what's going on right now, you know, and I want this easier, softer way. So I got a home group, and I started going there, and I was all happy and everything and making the coffee and meeting these new people. And then one day this friend of mine stopped by the house, and it was an old friend, and they hadn't seen me for a while. And they passed around one of those cigarettes. And I was like, no, y'all go ahead. Oh, no, we just knew you weren't drinking, but we thought you might want. And I was like, no, that's okay. And they said, well, we're going up here to the Timeout, which is a bar. And I said, and I'll see y'all in a little bit, because I still wanted to be in that crowd. And I love to play pool. And everybody I knew, I drank. And I know I'm getting ahead of myself here, but so they left. I went to the bathroom. I got dressed, put the makeup on, looking good, doing everything. Get out to this car that I'm not supposed to be driving. And then I hear y'all, one of y'all say, how long is it going to be before you get up there and you're going to have to either do what they're doing or not? And it just rang in. Here you are, Kelly. You're in this car and you're not supposed to be driving. And I got out, and I slammed the door, and I went in the house, and I started crying, and I was just so mad. And it was the first time that I didn't do what this brain said do. I want to back up really, really quick, and then that'll be it. Before that happened, that was like the end of July, but before that happened, people in AA kept telling me I needed to get honest and to let my son know what was going on. I was very good at hiding things, and he knew of a DUI. He didn't know how many. He didn't know I was on probation. Nobody came to my house. And they said, you're really going to have to get honest with him. So 3 days before I went to court, no lawyers calling, nobody's working out, nothing. So I told him the whole situation, the whole everything, that I didn't know what was going to happen on Friday. And I did ask him, I said, if they send me somewhere or I got to go somewhere, will you come and visit me? Because, you know, this, everybody in this point in my life, family, everybody, whoever, I didn't have anyone, but I knew I had this one boy that loved me unconditionally. And he looked me dead in my eyes, and he said, Mama, I don't know. You got to do what you got to do for you, and I got to do what I got to do for me, and I don't know. And he left. And when he left, something inside of me, something happened. And I hit my knees and I said, you know, you're really on your own now. There's nobody. You're really, you know, this is it. And I just said a simple prayer and I said, God, will you just please help me? And it won't, if you do this, I won't do that. It won't those foxhole prayers. And the next day on Thursday, before I had to go to court, my lawyer called and my felony got reduced to a misdemeanor and I did have to go to jail for 6 months. I was sitting in Lynchburg City Jail when I got off of probation for the welfare fraud checks. Now, all of that could have went the other way because that was 2.5 years, and then when I went to court, they wanted to give me 1 to 5, so I probably would have went to Fluvanna women's penitentiary, but it didn't work out like that. I don't know that that'll be your experience if you're going through anything like that, but that was mine. And so from that day forward, ever how haltingly or a little bit I would do at a time, I've tried to take that opportunity and run with it. And, you know, God has just done so many amazing things. Like I said, I had the home group. I was making the coffee. And this little old woman that's no longer with us, Margaret F., she'd say, "You ain't surrendered yet." I'd be like, "What are you talking about? You ain't surrendered yet." She's sitting out on the little stoop. And I was like, "Yeah, I have. You know, I'm not drinking. I'm making the coffee. I'm coming to the meeting." She said, "You see that little car over there?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "Are you supposed to be driving that?" And I was like, "Well, I'm making the coffee. I'm coming to..." She said, "Kelly, the cops are not going to care when they pull you over. And you've just gotten out of all of this." I went into the meeting that night, and all they talked about was how we turn our life and will over to the care of God. And they all started talking, and I started getting paranoid. And I left out of there crying, and one woman gave me a ride home, and Donnie J. drove the car home. And after that, I didn't drive no more. I mean, it was just... It just happened like that, you know. It's like... Even though I think I'm doing the right thing, I'm still not doing, you know, it's still for my own selfish, you know. So I had to start riding the bus. I had to start asking people for rides. I've always found if I can make it to a meeting some kind of way, somebody's going to give me a ride home. I mean, it just works. And, you know, so I got a sponsor and we started going through the steps, and she fired me because I'm kind of abrupt and abrasive, and she was a little bit laid back. So then I got another one. I've had 4 sponsors since I've been here, and so far on the last one I've had for 5 years, and that's good, and that's because they know how to talk to me, and I cannot manipulate them. And, you know, all they do is talk to me no matter what I'm going through. They say, "What meeting are you going to? Who are you picking up? Are you keeping your jail commitment?" I'm like, "Look, right now, I'd like for it to just be about me right now." And they said, "Kelly, that's your problem. It's always been about you. And now we are trying to be about God and about God's kids and what we can do there." And y'all have just showed me so much. And, you know, even when I was in another home group and somebody couldn't sponsor me and I thought everybody didn't like me, I still suited up and I showed up there anyway. You know, I still keep my commitments. We had a great correction workshop yesterday. And, I was really tired because my mother's broke her hip and broke her wrist since she's been here. And I'm working and I'm going to the nursing home. And I'm still trying to be available. And then I'm told, you know, through a girl that showed up yesterday, Christy E. was saying, you know, as long as we show up, God gives us that energy. And I'm like, "You're right. We get the energy." So early on, you know, that's what I did. I was able to get out of jail to go to my son's graduation. Not of anything good that I did. I guess they thought he was, you know, from a single parent and they needed his mom there. That doesn't happen from people that I sponsor that are in prison right now that can't get out to even go to a family's funeral. They let me get out to go to his graduation. I've got a good relationship with my son. I have 3 grandchildren. They're able to come up from Florida and spend time with me. He would never allow that if he knew that I was drinking. That would never, ever happen. If my mom had to fall and break her hip, it was good it happened in Lynchburg because I have siblings that try to take care of her, but they're in active addiction. So if it had to happen, she can depend on me here. I don't know how much time I got, but I just want to share, you know, one time, and this is how I came on fire for service work in all areas, but mainly corrections. You know, I went to my first assembly. I guess I was, 3 years sober, and I was really scared about going because this woman wanted to do a 4th step, and you know, I was just like, wasn't sure how that was going to turn out, but it was in Williamsburg, and I thought, well, if it don't turn out, I can call somebody around here and get away. I mean, I am from Newport News and Hampton. I can get away. Well, that opened my eyes to so much. We did our thing. She did her thing separate. And I went into the corrections committee workshop that they have on Friday night. And they were talking about all of this stuff there. And it was like, it's weird. It was like a deja vu thing that I felt like I'd been in that hotel because I'd been in many. But I knew I hadn't been in that one. And a man that was the DCM for Charlottesville then, you know, tapped me on the shoulder and he said, you know, would you like to come to Fluvanna and share your story? And when I left from there, I got to feeling kind of weird, like something is going on here. Like one way or the other, it seems like, you know, God or something or somebody wants to get me in one of these penitentiaries. And I don't know about all of that. You know, I just was so weird. But the man that went with us, Preston, that carries meetings to the Buckingham Prison in different places, I was so on fire, and I was like, you know, we need these meetings in Lynchburg, and Preston, I think you should go down and talk to the folks at the jail, and we got 5 regional jails, and, you know, we just need these meetings, and da-da-da-da-da, and he put his arm around me, and he said, Kelly, no, we will go down there, and we'll talk to them together. And I was like, but they're not going to want me. He said, it doesn't matter. He said, we're going to go. And so we did. And for the first 2.5 years, I couldn't go in because it hadn't been that long that I was out. So they want to see, you know, that you're serious in what you're doing. So it takes a little time. So I was the corrections chair long before I could go in. And I'd take the books down and whatever they need and kind of be the liaison. And then one day when I was in the lady's office giving her some literature, she said, you know, how long have you been sober now? And I think it was like 4 years, 4.5 years. She said, you can come in now. It was just given. And there's a good friend of ours, Tom I, that says when there's work to be done, the walls will come down. And I believe that. I believe that because there's a lot of folks out there that, you know, that's done way worse and super huge felony crimes that are now able to go back in. So if you don't think, oh, I've never been to jail, I don't have anything to offer, you know, what can I offer to them? We all know that's been incarcerated how to go to jail. We do not need help with that. But we do need for someone to show us how to stay sober when we get outside. That's what I don't know. That's what they don't know. We need somebody to walk with us, you know, with that. And I've certainly had a lot of people to walk with me on my journey. And, you know, I didn't think that I could ever really be of real use, you know, or have a real job, you know, or have anything. I'd think about things, and I don't know, I guess maybe it's been 14 years now. But I, you know, I got interested in this one thing, and it was like, it's a job what I do now. I'm a realtor now. And the person that was my sponsor at that time just said, Kelly, all you need to do is do the work and show up, and God's going to let whatever happen. And I was like, oh, it ain't going to happen. And sure enough, after 5 times, I passed this test. And then it says, the company I go to, have you ever been convicted of a felony? So I'm like, yeah, now they got me. Well, I went up before the 7-member board and the DPOR board, and I knew somebody that was on that committee that was one of us. And I had their phone number, and someone said out at AA, you can call and tell them and give them a heads up and da-da-da, and ask my sponsor about that. And they said, nope, you don't need to do that. You need to go there and explain it, and whatever happens, happens. They will be able to see this within you. You don't need to call nobody and try to. And so it was hard, but I did do that and went up, and my sponsor at that time went up with me too. And we left, and 2 weeks later, my license came in the mail. And I don't say that to say it's any big thing or anything, but for someone that was, you know, arrested 31 times and a felon and cheat and steal, and for me to have a key from, you know, Lynchburg to Smith Mountain Lake to Charlottesville to go in your home, that's a big deal. That's a big deal of where now I know I'm a productive member of society. I know that I am. And so that's what I try to pass on to these women that I sponsor. And I wanted to share real quick. I'm sponsoring this one lady up in Fluvanna, and she's got 10 years. She threw a chair and hit a man that was older, and he died of complications and whatever. They made an example out of her for second-degree murder. And she's been down for 6 years. And she is going to the meeting in there. She is sponsoring 3 ladies that come into her quad, and she calls me, and on the times that I feel like just instead of turning off on 64, I want to keep driving towards D.C., but I think I got that commitment, I need to go. When I go, she is so happy to see me, but not because I'm there for a visitation. She's happy because she wants to know about me. She wants to know, you know, how can I make these amends while I'm in here? What can I share with these girls? How are you doing? How's it going with your marriage? Just she's interested in me, and here I'm thinking, you know, and every time I go and I leave, I have so much gratitude. And it's not because she's there and I'm not. It's just because she's helped me. One alcoholic talking to another, that's how we get through this thing. And you know, I am just so blessed beyond measure. You know, I could go on and I could just go on, and it's not enough time. But I do believe that, you know, if I'm asked to do something here, I should try to make every effort to do it. And the correctional facility thing is, don't make a commitment if you can't show up, because it does look bad on us. We really need for people to come when they say that they're going to come. And if you can't do that, then maybe there's something else for you to do. I'm not going to quote it or anything, but in this book it talks about how you and the new man must walk hand in hand together, you know, and if you do, great events will come to pass for you and countless others. So I know that I need to do this with someone else. And by me doing it with them, it takes me back through the steps. By doing it with my sponsor, you know, I get a clear vision every time. And I still have one of the original big books I have. I'm kind of bad about, like, giving it away, because the last workshop I went to, they gave us all a new big book and said, you're going to have a new experience now, which means these are old ideas. Not that you can't use them, but you're going to have a new experience. So how about giving that one, Kelly, to somebody that could use it? And I haven't quite gotten there yet to do that. But, you know, I mean, sooner or later I will do that. But it's like we're starting brand new, and every time that I look at that and I see me and I write about me, it's totally different today than what I first came in with. It's totally different. So every day I'm trying to practice one of these steps, or I'm reviewing the day, or I'm doing something. But I will tell you that the folks that have helped me the most, because I'm hard-headed, I can at least say that they all have been grounded in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they've been grounded in the first 164 pages of their book, of this book. They didn't just say, come to meetings and don't take a drink and your life's going to get great, because it's not. It's going to get different, and then it's going to get good, but it's only if I'm trying to do some of this stuff here. That's all that I can talk about, you know, and it's kind of, I want to just share this and be quiet. I was talking with my sponsor, and I was saying, you know, it seems like we're in the minority that do this. And they said, yeah, we are, because AA's getting watered down throughout the whole, you know, United States and wherever, and it's what people hear as they come in. They can only pass on what they've got, you know. So it's like, you know, what is it, take some and leave the rest and all of that and everything. None of that says that in here. And so, you know, when I take women through the steps, or I'm with my sponsorship family, when it says read, we write, we pray. And there's a whole bunch of people out there that really don't believe that. But I've also seen a whole bunch of those people that's been in out die since I've been here. People with more long-term sobriety than I, and not so much. Because that's all they thought. They just go to this meeting and I'm going to be okay. What about the other 23 hours out there? You know, what are we going to do then? You know, so I don't really have anything else to share. I really don't. I hope I wasn't all over the place. I just know I'm grateful that y'all asked me to come to speak. And, you know, if you're new here, please give this thing a chance and hook up with the people that you see that are happy and they're doing something and they're very active. I just know the more I got active in AA, it took my mind off of me, at least for a short period of time. It just really did, and it's just worked, and I'm not going to quit coming, because only good has happened from it. And even when the bad has came, because bad comes. I mean, bad comes. I separated from my husband 5 years ago for a year because I thought I knew everything. And, you know, I found myself at this stop-in store to get cigarettes. I was so devastated about what was going on. And I briefly looked at the beer cooler. It won't long. And I recoiled, like it says, like a hot flame. And I got the cigarettes and I went home, because I had enough insurance in my bank. I had been calling people. I'd been keeping the commitment. I came home. I fell going up these three flights of stairs to this apartment that I didn't have no business being in, but I thought I knew everything. And And so throughout that process, that's gotten worked out. But I didn't have to drink that night. But y'all were there for me to call on the phone, and I'd been coming. And then it just says, God will stand between me and a drink. When you can't get a sponsor and you can't get to a meeting, you know, I'm glad to know that I've got a higher power in my life today that I can call upon when maybe somebody else can't answer the phone, because that's going to be, you know, my higher power is the one that's going to stand between me and a drink. I can go to 90 meetings in 90 days and have 90 sponsors, and I can do a lot. But when those are not around and you can't find no one on that list and it's just you and God, then you're going to know. And I know because that's been proven to me over and over again. And so I'm trying to build upon that relationship. And thanks for letting me share. Thank you.